Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh,
Jimmy. Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and we're sponsored by the Improv-A-Roo Camping Retreat. Now, if you're interested in camping under the stars while attending improv workshops with a really supportive, genuine community, then you gotta check out the Improv-A-Roo Camping Retreat, taking place February 18th through the 21st at the beautiful Camp Bro-Ryan, just north of Tampa, Florida. Improv-A-Roo features top instructors from the I.O., the Groundlings, the Magnet, and more. All you have to do is go to postdinnerconvo.com/improvaroo for all the details. That's postdinnerconvo.com/improvaroo. And we're also sponsored by the Houston Improv Festival, and submissions are now open for the Houston Improv Festival through January 31st. This year, the festival's at the brand new, state-of-the-art Midtown Arts and Theater Complex in Houston, Texas. In addition to great shows, workshops, and after parties, there'll also be a pub crawl and other fun events at uniquely Houston destination. I went last year and I had a great time. The festival is April 28th through May 1st, and submissions are only $25. All you gotta do is go to HoustonImprovFestival.com/submissions. That's HoustonImprovFestival.com/submissions. And don't forget to check out my award-winning artist-level comedy improv classes and workshops here in Chicago. Starting February 17th, I'll be offering my 6-week class, Fundamentals of Improv. And then on Saturday, May 7th, I'll be holding a 1-day, 4-hour artist-level comedy workshop. And then in the summer, look for my 2-day artist-level comedy intensives, July 23rd and 24th, or August 6th and 7th. To register, all you need to do is go to my slick new website at JimmyCarain.com. That's JimmyCarain.com. Guess what I got for you today? Just take a guess. No. I don't have a carton of milk. No. I don't have a Red Bull. Yes, you got it. On the third try, you finally got it. Yes, I've got another great episode of Improv Nerd for you. And our guest today is Shayna Merlin. She is the owner and founder of Merlin Works in Austin, Texas. She's a well-respected teacher and improviser who has quite a following. She started teaching improv way back in 1995, and she's in an elite class of improvisers who actually make a living at it. In this lively and very passionate episode, recorded at the Institution Theater in Austin, Texas, we talked to her about how she felt teaching improv at a very young age of 22. Her view on there are no mistakes in improv and how the reality of having a baby can affect the business of running an improv theater. Before we get to Shayna, let's talk about me. Tomorrow I'm planning to go out to lunch with my older brother, Bobby. And I'm always hesitant to agree to go because we always end up spending the whole time trashing my parents, which on one hand I love. I know this is going to come as a surprise to you, but I love talking about other people. I love making fun of other people. I love trashing other people. And I know it's not good for me, but for me, it's like an addiction. It's like taking a drug or a drink. Once I take that first drink, I can't stop. And the sad thing is, that's how my family grew up. That's how we connected with each other. I think I've told this story before, but at holidays, like Thanksgiving or Christmas, we could hardly wait till our relatives left so we could all make fun of them and trash them. I know I'm sick. I know I have a problem with it. It's something that I want to stop, because it isn't helping me in my life at all. And my wonderful, smart wife came up with this great idea. Why don't you say yes, you'll go to lunch with your brother, but you'd like to set a time limit that you will be willing to talk about your parents. I'm not sure about that, to be totally honest with you. I mean, it sounds good, but it's almost like, I don't know if I can say it to my brother, because I enjoy talking about my parents so much. So, enough about me. Here it is. You're going to love this episode from the Institution Theater in Austin, Texas, the Shayna Merlin episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd. Jimmy's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. Jimmy's a nerd.
All right. You grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and
yes.
you were in theater in high school. And yeah. how were the Atlanta Braves responsible for you getting into improv?
They were essential to my improv journey. So when I was in high school, I was going to an improv theater called Dad's Garage, which is it's a blessing that I got started there, and they're still going strong today. And so I was like a 16-year-old high school girl going, trying to find an all-ages place to like hang out that wasn't in the suburbs of Atlanta. So me and my friends would go down to Dad's Garage, and we went one night, and we showed up for the show, and they were like, the show's canceled. The Braves are in the World Series tonight. Mm-hmm. And we're like, what? Like, because we're teenage girls and drama nerds. So the person, the volunteer working the box office is like, I'm so sorry, there's no show tonight here, and just hands us this huge stack of free passes. Like, not really thinking that we're going to use all of them. So we come to the theater every weekend using these passes. And so we're, like, completely addicted. I start taking a class there, and kind of the rest is history.
And so how old were you when you started?
I was, like, 15 when I started taking improv.
And how were you when you first started?
I was terrible.
And when you say terrible, like, how bad?
Like, you know, kind of like want to pat me on the head, like, oh, it's okay, sweetheart. Like, you're really a sweet girl. So, yeah, I mean, I remember, like, I have a memory of doing word at a time story around
one word
the circle.
At a time, yeah.
And, like, it coming to me and it, like, breaking down every time. I remember because somebody used the word cotton as a verb, which I had never heard before.
Yes.
And so I was like, cotton picking. Or no, they were just like, no, let's start over, you know? And like, it kept being like that. I was me.
But they tolerated you.
Yeah.
Yeah. No one kicked you out.
No. And I like to. I think that a lot of my early improv success, as far as like not being excluded or kicked out, was that I was a young girl with a big laugh, and so most comedians like having that around, makes them feel good. So, like, you know, and they probably thought I was dumb, even though I wasn't. So, like, I think it was like a good compliment to whatever was happening.
So you were this theater and musical theater and high school nerd, right?
Yeah.
In the drama club and stuff like that.
Yeah.
What was it about improv that all of a sudden you were like, I love this more than theater and musical improv?
Well, I always like the first like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I wanted to be a writer, but then
what kind of writing stuff did you want?
I wrote a lot of poetry when I was, like, little. Like, I wrote a poem for Martin Luther King Day and got to read it on the announcements at my elementary school.
Do you remember any of it?
Well, so I was just cleaning out my dad's house. He's moved out of a house. So I was going through all these papers. I found all these poems. So I know it began, Martin Luther King has something to bring. All over this world that people can care and always share. Something like that. A land. It was all over this land. A lending, helping hand. You can imagine the beauty of this poem. So, yeah, I was always, like, writing and liked to write, but I'm also, like, really extroverted. So I would kind of, like, as I got older, I'd only write when there was, like, poetry club and I could perform it. Like, I only was motivated to write when I could perform. And so, like, improv was really merging that, like, you're the writer, you're the director, you're the actor, and you're the casting agent, where you get to pick the roles that you want to play. So that kind of really drew me. I really like being in control of all those things. And then I also like being out of control, because you're totally making it up on the spot with other people. So, like, that tension I find is, like, a really satisfying space to be in.
So then you go to college. You go to the University of Texas here in Austin.
At the Horns.
And the Longhorns. That's, is that just...
what a hometown crowd they have.
It's great that you can just put your
much more for Dad's Garage. Awesome. For our own largest sports fan.
So you tried out for an improv team on campus and you didn't make it, right?
I did not make it. Thank you, Brentley Heelron. I did not.
Why are they going
on? He's a teacher here at the institution theater.
Okay.
And a wonderful guy who I am friends with.
Okay, looking back, why don't you think you made it?
I told you I sucked.
So here you are. This is like 3 years later, right?
Yeah.
And you still sucked.
Yeah, I think.
Believe me. I started at 18. I sucked up until I was about 48.
Wow.
So,
yeah. So I'm getting the good stuff.
Yeah, you're getting the salad years right now. You're gonna look back and go, wow, that last 2 months with Jimmy was amazing.
I think that I probably, like, if I was trying to imagine myself in that audition, I think I was just, like, trying really hard and, like, really wanting people to like me and really not wanting to mess up, you know? And that doesn't make for great improv.
How did you get over that?
Just doing a lot of improv, I think, you know? And then I think when I got in a group where I had kind of a leader position, and that helped me, like, get the confidence to be like, this is how you do it, or, you know, I think teaching and leading has really, you know, fed me as a performer and made me feel, like, more confident.
So getting back, you didn't make this team at University.
It was called 90% Effective.
Okay. And you didn't make it. But
I was
then,
at 10%,
but
yeah.
Then you say, you know, I don't know, how'd you feel about not making it?
I mean, I was bummed. I was, like, kind of, you know, I'd always grown up and, like, done school plays. Like, I never done a lot of auditions where it's, like, you don't get... like, everything I'd done was, like, you pay for the camp and everybody gets a part, you know, kind of thing. And I auditioned and I didn't get in, you know. So that was, like, that sucked.
But you say, I'm going to go and see what's going on in Austin.
Yeah, because the university didn't have a lot of theater and improv for undergrads at the time. So I went to an audition down on 6th Street at the Velveeta Room. And Michael Joplin drove me and Jeremy Lamb to this audition down at the Velveeta Room for a Monk's Night Out farm team. This is back in, like, 98.
Where do you think you got the chutzpah? Because a lot of people that will get on campus, they will not leave campus. Where'd you get that chutzpah to be like, even though I didn't make it, I'm going to go and see what else there is out there?
I don't know. I think I was like, I do improv. Like, and if there's improv, I should go do that. Because that's what I do.
So shortly after you're on Monk's Night Out, right?
Well, I got on a farm team called Los Paranoias, mm-hmm. like a little, and yeah.
And then,
a sketch review and a improv show.
And your confidence is building.
Yeah, we got to play at the Big Stinkin' Comedy Festival. That was the big deal back in the day. And got to play at the Velveeta Room, which is like a club downtown, you know. Pretty, like, fancy.
And then you graduate from college in 2000.
Yes.
And you start teaching and working as an administrator at the Hideout Theater.
Yeah, so that was my first job out of college, was helping open and run the Hideout Theater.
What was the best part of that job?
The best part of that job... you know, Sean Hill founded the Hideout Theater, and he was a real mentor for me. So he really encouraged me to go take improv training from Keith Johnstone up in Canada and go out to California and do these intensives. And he gave me these opportunities to, like, teach when I was, like, the youngest person in the room. And
you were, like, 22, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I was, like, yeah, I taught a lot of people that were older than me. And,
was that scary?
Yeah, you know, I think it's part of, like, I think it's gone away now that I've gotten older, but I think I was also, like, I felt like I really had to prove myself, you know, and, like, make it, like, this is extremely educational and valuable, and, you know, and I've done the learning, and I've studied, you know.
Were you kind of, like, a hard ass about it?
I think I was, like, a school marm about it, Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'd done my work, and this is how we do it, and this is the, you know, and here's the lesson, and, you know, and I think it took me, and, you know, I used to pack my curriculum, like, full of, like, new things every week, and this idea, and that concept, or whatever, and it took me a while to be like, I think people want to have fun. Like, I should probably, like, slow down and like, focus on that more and less getting so much out of every lesson kind of thing. I also had a lot of, like, dudes let me know that they didn't think I had anything to teach them.
Give me an example. What would they say? Was it during class and stuff?
There was a lot of, like, guys that were older than me that would kind of take one class and, like, not come back or be like, ask me about my credentials or, like, dismiss my feedback in class or something like that.
And how did you deal with that?
I you know, in some ways I'm like, you know, if you don't think I have a lot to teach you, I probably can't teach you anything. You know, so, like, you should come back when you...
Here's what I love about you. Like, if that happened to me, and that's happened to me, people have questioned, you know, especially when
right.
you start out, I would be like, it's about me. You know, like, what am I doing wrong?
Right.
But you seem to be like, it's their problem, move on. Is that basically it?
I mean, I would get a little, like, shaky at the time, but basically...
But you wouldn't take it personally.
I would take it politically.
Well, explain that.
I would feel like it was about gender, and it was about age, and it wasn't about me and them. You know what I mean? So,
mm-hmm.
And I think it's good I had a real, like, journey for me as far as, like, gender and improv and comedy and stuff. And when I started at Dad's Garage, it was all dudes.
Mm-hmm.
They were all adorable, and I was, like, in love with each of them in a different way.
Okay.
That is part of why I sucked, because it was really hard to be, like, I couldn't grok being, like, attractive and being funny. Like, those seemed incompatible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was there more to laugh than to be comedic. So kind of how I embraced my, like, comedic persona is I went butch. So I, like, kind of played gender-neutral characters before it was really cool to be gender-neutral all the time. This is in the 90s or whatever. So, you know, so I would kind of, like, not mostly play male characters for, like, years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind of, once I got through that and got some confidence, kind of swung back into the other direction and was like, I think I'll be a lady now and also be funny.
Did you get a note a lot of times, like, why don't you play a woman tonight? You've been playing guys for the last 4 years. Did you get that kind of stuff by directors? Or how did you come up?
There was this kind of heartbreaking moment when I was at an intensive with Keith Johnstone, who's a genius and has so much to offer, but not necessarily the most progressive feminist there is.
could he be a little harsh, like Del?
There's a line that I really remember where he said something like, women should be women on stage and not men with tits. And although I didn't like the way he said that, I was like, oh, like, it also helped me, like, be like, oh, well, maybe I could be a woman sometimes also and be fun. You know what I mean? Like, I think it was a good journey to eventually meld those parts of myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
And then, so you're at the Hideout for about 3 years, right?
Yeah.
And you decide to, in 2003, start your own business called Merlin Works.
Yes.
Which is improv classes, shows, corporate training.
Yes.
And you said you never really planned to be an entrepreneur.
No, in fact, I planned not to be an entrepreneur.
Why?
So my mom, who's in the audience, was an entrepreneur for 30 years. And I wrote an essay, like, in fifth grade about, like, why I will never run my own business.
was it in poem form?
It was a diatribe. diatribe. Okay. It was a manifesto. Because my parents, my mom is especially, is extremely hardworking. And my dad worked on this business as well. So they worked a lot. And it was in our home. So we had an office in our house. So people that were not related to us would come to our house in the morning and show up to work in the office and, you know, go home at the end of the day and stuff like that. So it was like a big part of our, like I would be in the kitchen eating cereal and they would like come in and get their coffee. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And, so I was just like, no, you have no control over your life and your schedule and your space and it's all consuming and, you know, and when you're on your own business, like my dad was like, say, oh, you have the privilege of cleaning out the clogged toilets and, you know, all the stuff that nobody wants to do. That's like your job. You know, it's like you get the top stuff and the bottom stuff. So, yeah, I totally did not want to open my own business. But there's not like, oh, I'll just go apply at Improv Incorporated and, you know, you have to make your own.
So how did you make peace with that to start your own business?
I did it very small and very slow. And I think, you know, at the time it was kind of probably for 2 or 3 years felt like a pretend business, kind of fake it till you make it. Mm-hmm. You know, like I had my friend make a logo and I made my own website. Like I used Notepad to code it in HTML and I printed business cards on my home printer and like fold, you know, and like, you know, on the little like tear them apart so the edges were all fuzzy. You know what I mean? Like, but I'd be like, yes, I have this business. My husband and I both kind of opened our own businesses around the same time. So I think that was also like, we really helped each other kind of like cheerlead each other on to build and grow their
businesses. What did you learn from your mom in terms of starting your own business?
Oh my gosh. what did I learn from my mom in terms of starting my mom, like her work ethic. She's just a beast. I mean, she works so hard. And her business, so the business that she ran was a in-home care, child care agency. And she was always very passionate about taking care of children. You know, she was a stay-at-home mom till I was 6. And she, you know, and so I think it was very much a personal and passion business and profitable for her, you know, but it was like, it was about her values and like her beliefs and like what she wanted to put in the world. And I feel like, you know, I feel proud that like my business is very much like, here's the message that I want to share in the limited time I have with people. And like,
but what is the message of Merlin Works?
I think that the primary thing that I teach people, especially I have all these classes, but a lot of people, I just teach them for hour, 2 hours or something like that. And the thing that I'm teaching them is how to be fun to be with, how to have fun, how to make things fun for themselves, how to make things fun for the people they're working with, how to make it fun for anybody that's watching. And like, I think I give them like practical tools to like make whatever they're doing more fun. And I think that's like makes everything better.
And in terms of your teaching philosophy, when you're teaching students that want to learn, not corporate people, mm-hmm. but what is your philosophy in that?
Well, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's the same thing, because I think that whatever you want to learn, if you're the kind of person that's fun to work with, you're going to learn it, because people are going to invite you along mm-hmm. and teach you things. And you know what I mean? You're going to make it, because people want to work with good people. So I feel like that's the first step, is just like being cool to be have around.
How do you teach that? Because I've been doing this for a long time. Right. I struggle with having fun in my own life. I can do a pretty good job of teaching people how to have fun.
Right.
But how do you do it specifically?
So I have a little acronym that I've created called EPIC, which many of my students are in the audience and know what that is. So the E is for
energy.
We like to. this is called Improv Nerd.
Right. It's very interesting to watch your face because you're blushing. It's almost like you're embarrassed by this. Is there a little embarrassment to this?
Well, you know, it's always funny because there's always that running joke of like, improv teacher, improv theater person slash cult leader, you know, where's the line? You know, is this an art form? Is it an art club? Is it a cult? Like, you know what I mean? And so, like, sometimes when you have, like, a group of people, like, just spontaneously chanting something you've taught them all, it can feel a little like...
You're the cult
leader. The Kool-Aid. Yeah.
All right, we're not done with... We got through E.
What's E is for energy. So okay. We like to work with people that bring energy to the project, energy to the team, energy, physical, vocal, emotional energy.
Okay.
P is for...
Pacing.
So in improv, we like to go fast, outrace your brain, get in the moment, take more risks, mess up more with the pacing thing.
Okay.
I is for...
In the moment.
Yeah. So that's about getting outside of yourself, focusing on others, eye contact and connection. Mm-hmm. And C is for...
Commitment.
I had no commitment.
That was the... Yeah.
C is for...
Commitment!
You take the game seriously. Take the game seriously and yourself not. So you make the choice... Right, you don't make the right choice.
What is your philosophy about the making mistakes in improv, failing in improv, stuff like that? How do you deal with that? Because people are terrified when they first start making mistakes.
I feel like you have to change your relationship with failure if you want to live in the present moment. And you have to do that through practice. So, in improv class, you get a chance to... take risks, mess up, and bounce back from it. And when you do that enough times, you can let go of your dread of future failure and your dwelling on past failure, which frees you up to be present and in the moment.
Now, in your class, if someone screws up, they take a bow, and it's called the failure bow?
Yeah, circus bow, failure bow.
Okay, so explain that behind your thought behind that.
All right, yeah, this is like... day one stuff. So anytime you feel like you goofed up, you messed up, you smile, you lift your arms up, kind of like you just planted a gymnastics move.
Okay.
And you say, I failed. And everybody applauds you.
So let me play devil's advocate.
Okay.
What about there are no mistakes in improv?
I don't believe that.
Okay.
I'm glad you brought that up because that's something like I actually have a real point of view about. So people are like, there's no wrong choices. Yeah, there are. Like, I've been in that show. You know what I mean? Like, so you could say something racist or sexist or demeaning or something that doesn't make any sense because you're not listening or whatever, you know? So there's like, there's some better choices and some worse choices and some bad choices. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And those things happen, and they happen not infrequently. So I think it's false to say, like, say whatever. It's all equally good. It's like, no. Instead, mistakes are going to happen. Failures are going to happen. Let's find a way to deal with it and be buoyant and bounce back from it.
So if someone brings up one of those 4 points that you just mentioned, how do you handle it?
Something sexist or racist awful or something like that. So that's what I like to frame it, not in like, hey, that's not okay here. Because I think that's a little bit like, it's really contextual. Mm-hmm. All that stuff, you know, like I hang out with comedians and we say some crazy stuff, right? But if you frame it, sorry, it's cedar season, I guess it's beginning right now.
What is cedar season?
Cedar. Welcome to Austin, Texas. So,
I know barbecue. I understand barbecue, cedar season is new.
It's a pollen in the air that is released at this time of year that people, your Facebook feed just fills with people complaining about their allergies. It's a delightful time in Austin.
So you're saying somebody says...
So if someone says something off-color, offensive, taboo, I like to frame it in the context of trying to be fun to work with and being like, hey, that doesn't look like it's fun for this person that's playing with you. Because you can see that as a teacher, as a director. You go, oh, that's not fun. So, like, let's not do that. You know what I mean? And then I don't have to get into an argument of like, is that okay? Is that acceptable? Is that PC or whatever? We're talking about in this group, in this room, in this moment, that's not a fun choice for everybody. Let's take good care of each other. Let's focus on each other. Let's make each other look good. Let's go a different way.
You also said that if students complain they aren't getting enough feedback, you tell them to go take Asif Ronan's class. Asif.
Yeah.
Why don't you like to give feedback? What's your theory behind that?
It's not that I don't like to give feedback. I do like to give feedback. But I feel that people perform their best when they feel safe. And that when they're in a supported environment, they feel free to take risks, to try new things, to be coached into a better version of themselves or a better performance than they could do alone. So I feel like if you give too much feedback, people shut down and you're not going to be able to access that. I mean, I think I have a very psychological approach to teaching improv. So I think, you know, you've got to take these baby steps. And if you give too much feedback too fast, it's going to send them back.
What is you say you've got a psychological approach? How have you been in therapy and stuff and you applied it to it? On the podcast, I talk very openly about my therapy. I mean, group therapy twice a week.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah, I love it. I'm serious. It's changed me as a teacher.
Really? Mm-hmm. I have seen a therapist. I've seen a therapist with my husband. I've seen a therapist as an individual. I'm very, like,
I love couples, by the way, too. My wife and I go to that. Yes.
I'm pro-therapy. I am not a therapist. And I don't have any formal training as a counselor or therapist. So I think improv is therapeutic. Can be therapeutic, but it's not therapy.
You also have two kids. And yes. They're almost 2 and 4.
I should go to more therapy.
And you said when you had your kids, your business dropped off a little.
Yeah. No, it plummeted.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah.
And tell us how you brought it back.
So you kind of, you know, when you're about to have a kid and there's all this anticipation, you kind of like, what am I going to plan for the other side? I don't know. Like, I just have to figure out when I get there. Am I going to want to go back to work? Am I going to stay home? And so I thought, okay, well, I have other teachers. I have a registrar. I'll have them teach my classes for a while, and then I'll see, like, you know, how much I can come back, how fast, and whatever. And my improv, my business was just 3 months in, was just dying. And well, FYI, having a kid is bad for your career. I don't know if anybody knew that. I was just shocked how fast it happened. And it also really just killed my, like, competitive spirit. I was just like, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I was wanting to, you know, there's a lot of improv theaters in town and they're always like, what are they doing? How can I keep up and all this stuff? And I was just like, I give up. Like, I don't want to. I can't. Like, I'm just, you know. And so I was really, like, ready. I was like, you know what? Maybe I'll just, like, it's time to shut it down. Like, I really was there. And I'm kind of talking to people close to me about that. Like, I think I'm done. Like, I think it's over, you know. And because I just couldn't see a way through. And then I actually had a great conversation. I was out with my kid at a park, and I ran into a good friend of mine, Karen Lachelle, who is the executive director of Creative Action, which is a kind of arts for youth nonprofit in town. And I told her that. I was like, yeah, I think I'm done. And she was just like, no, like, you're not. And let's talk. And she had this great meeting with me and helped, like, me see, like, another path through. And that's where I decided to start making steps to move to Zach Theater, where I am now, and changing my business model some. And kind of we came back kind of stronger than ever. So it was a rough path and a good finish.
What'd you learn from that?
that you have to, like, I don't think I would be where I am now if I had stayed where I was. That makes no sense. That's a really dumb thing to say. You have to let, I mean, it's such an improv lesson, right? You have to let go of how you have in your mind how things are supposed to go before you can even see what other options there are, right? So I had to truly accept the end of my business to see a different way of moving forward.
It's almost like you had to, there was a bottoming out, like you hit bottom with it, and then you came back up. And, as a parent, how do you use improv?
I think the main improv thing, I use Meisner technique constantly. So
the advanced repetition?
Yeah, just trying to see and say what I see.
Right. You look, to, if you were your kid, you'd say you look sad to your kid.
Yeah.
And your, did, would your kid come back and say, like in Meisner, I look sad. You look sad?
Their Meisner technique is very weak.
I would imagine.
But it's, it really helps me find this other option. So if there's, the kid's having a crisis, right?
A meltdown.
Oh my God. So, okay, so today.
Okay.
A few many hours ago. One of the worst things I find I can do for my 3-year-old is give him a present. It just brings out the worst in him. And we opened a present. It was like something from left over from his birthday that I just found because I've stashed all these toys away to dole them out at times of crisis. And
it's kind of like your insurance policy.
Right? Yeah.
Would you like my poem that I wrote in eighth grade?
So you give him a toy and he's excited. He's really excited for a second. And because he imagines what this toy is. And he has an idea that it lights up and it's motorized and you can remote control it or whatever. It was just a model car. It was just a metal.
So he looks at the box and he has all these thoughts that it's...
And then he starts to play with it and he's just inconsolable with how this toy does not match up to the idea that he had of this toy in his mind just moments before. So... oftentimes, my instinct or many parents' instinct, you want to try and, they're feeling a feeling, right? And most of us as humans are just like wanting them to stop having that feeling because it's uncomfortable.
Right.
When you're upset.
Right.
And you don't want to make it okay.
And those kind of parents, we end up doing improv because they pushed our feelings down.
So
your mom excluded. Your mom excluded. Because she was too busy running a very successful
And I'm the youngest of four.
Right.
So she was also busy with four
kids. Right. She was done by the time you came. You could raise yourself.
So it's a great improv practice. So you're my kid, you're in crisis, and instead of trying to...
I'm angry.
Instead of trying to distract you, to make you stop feeling those feelings, oh, look at that. Look at this other toy. Play with that, right? Or instead of trying to fix it, which I did a little bit. I was like, maybe it does have batteries.
It doesn't, Mom. It doesn't have batteries.
Right. And instead of trying to tell them it's okay, and they don't need to feel that way. It's just a toy. It's fine, right?
Mm-hmm.
So instead of doing all those things, trying to fix it, trying to diminish their feelings, trying to distract their feelings, just going, you really wanted this toy to fly. You wanted this toy to light up. You're having a hard time. You're sad. You look really angry right now. And just reflecting and accepting and not trying to do all those other things. I'm not saying it's a save-all, but it helps me have something to do that often, so we can move through it to the next thing.
I've heard other parents say that it's really important, and this may kill improv the next generation. So just that's an FYI. There. But to validate the kid's feeling,
right.
You're feeling sad. I understand you feel sad that we can't get an ice cream cone. I'd really like to have an ice cream cone, but we got to go home right. and have dinner. A lot of parents say that that really, really works.
Yeah, and I'm still holding on to my reality, so I'm not saying it does fly.
Right.
I'm not yes-anding it in that way, right? I'm saying it, you know, this is, you know.
I'm thinking when you're telling that story, because we're expecting a...
You are?
Yes, we're going to have a girl. And,
I didn't know that!
And this is where my mind goes. It's like that huge expectation. I'd want to just run my kid off to therapy to find out what...
What's wrong with this guy?
Yes. You know, where's the disconnect? Yeah. There's nothing wrong with it, but what's causing that?
Right. Yeah.
Do you ever think of that?
Yeah. You know, I think the instinct to want to prevent suffering of your child is a really deep and, like, eternal instinct, and not a bad one, but it's also impossible. But there's a lot of things where you're like, is this normal? Is this okay? And like, well, he's a 3-year-old boy. Like... It's in the realm of normal.
Well, you may find out if you had him check. Like, he's got this great imagination. It sounds like he has a great imagination, too, you know?
Yes. So. He's hugely. I mean, he's heartbreakingly imaginative. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's a very upsetting way to be imaginative, you know? Your nightmares are terrifying. Your hopes are constantly dashed.
He's got a very good chance of being an improv. Yeah. All right, speaking of improv, why don't we improvise now? So we're going to improvise. We're going to do a scene that's never been done before.
By the way, we have been improvising this whole time.
We have been. Okay, good.
But we're going to
What about my question? Okay, great. That's good to know. Because sometimes I forget myself. I get so into to. But when you say that, we've been improvising since we could talk. Is that what you're...
Yeah, so my company slogan is, you improvise every day, why not get good at it? You know, and so I go into these like corporate settings and people are like terrified, I'm going to have to improvise. And so then I have them do a game where they have to talk to somebody and find two things in common. And I'm like, so that's improv. You had a conversation. Like, you know, it's nothing, it's not something that's... It's familiar to everyone. It's what we're doing it all the time. Very little goes as planned.
But even someone like me who's in it forgets it sometimes.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, we think of it. Yeah. There's a formal improv of like,
right.
Let us pretend to be characters in a different place doing something.
And that's what we're going to do right now.
Yes.
So what we need is a suggestion.
Jungle.
Okay. So you hear the suggestion jungle. Mm-hmm. And how does your creative process work?
It probably speaks to the day and age and the conversation, but like the first thing is I'm like, oh God, let's not do something offensive. Like I'm thinking about like Native people and like all that portraying, you know, and like, let's not, I hope I don't have to do an insulting version of a Native person is my first
thought. That's your first thought?
Yeah. Yeah, but I've done a lot of scenes in jungles, so. So, I mean, what are our choices, right? Like, we could be white people going into the jungle. Mm-hmm. We could be animals mm-hmm. or creatures in the jungle. We could be natives in the jungle. Mm-hmm. Or we could, but I'm a pretty, like, literal person, so I don't usually try and do, like, a second level, like, it's a jungle out there.
Okay, great. So let's do that. Let's stretch you a little.
Okay,
so that's the first one. And the first one is, I don't want to offend anybody.
Yeah.
So we've got that off the table.
Okay.
So the second one, yes. Jungle, what do you...
Like concrete jungle, like the city, mm-hmm. like it's a jungle out there, like some kind of like intense work atmosphere or something like that.
Okay.
What is that book, the Jungle, about?
Upton Sinclair was about
meat
packing and stuff like that. Okay.
But that took me a while. That was not my first thing. But we can use it now.
Is your first thought usually I don't want to offend, or is it just in this thing?
That yeah, no, I think that's just like that specific.
Do you
suggestion.
Think that fear or whatever? Do you think sometimes that gets in your way?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, it's like a spectrum of like how in the moment do you want to live, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you could live so in the moment that you're like constantly offending and hurting people because things are just like things unprocessed or purely spilling out of your mouth. And you can live totally out of the moment where you never, you know, you're always double checking everything before it comes out. So, I mean, I feel like there's like a sweet spot, maybe three quarters of the way in, but I don't want to be 100% in the moment, I guess. Okay. For in my life.
Okay. Would you say 90% in the...
I'm saying 75%.
Okay, great. You know, I'm a very, you know, I'm very logical. Let's give us another suggestion and we're just going to...
Trump rally.
Pardon?
Trump rally.
Trump rally.
Trump
okay,
rally.
Great. Trump rally.
Great.
Susan.
Yes. Did you get rid of that Muslim lady?
Yes, I got rid of her. No more Muslims. No more blacks.
Wait, you're freaking me out.
I know. We got rid of them.
Did you check her for bombs?
Yes, of course I checked her for bombs. Good. They're deporting her right now.
Thank goodness.
All right.
I mean, she had a bomb on? No.
No, she didn't. Okay. But let me tell you what I did.
What?
I planted one on her.
Ah!
Because I know eventually she's gonna have a bomb. Yes.
Touch of the chin.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
America needs to know.
Yeah. So I. So, all right.
Yeah, because that visual was not.
No.
Gonna work.
That was not gonna work.
And you got rid of the black guy too.
Oh, got rid of him. Yeah. That was no problem. I can't give you a high five. I don't want to be considered racist. You know what I'm saying? Alright. So they've asked me, you and I, they got a serious problem.
What?
The Mexican problem.
Oh.
Alright? Okay.
You see someone come across the border to this rally?
Two people. Okay? Alright? And they're in the front row.
What?
Yeah, they're sitting right in the front row. Alright, and they're eating nachos of all things.
Did you give them the nachos?
Of course I gave them the nachos. Okay? And I also threw in a sombrero. Yes. Okay. Now, we're getting a lot of flack, okay? Because people think, all right, that are watching it right now,
yeah,
that those two Mexican people are taking away jobs from Americans. From
and
white people.
Seats
too, all right? That's the bigger crime. You're right. That is the bigger
crime.
Seats
at a Trump rally. What could be more valuable?
Nothing. All right?
Okay.
So, we're going to go out there, okay?
It's mid-rally. I mean, he's...
I understand.
He's in his
speech right now.
Yeah.
So we've got to go in there very inconspicuously, all right? And we've got to remove them.
All right. I mean, we are his image consultants.
Right. So
that is our job. Now, can I just...
Please,
between you and
please.
Me, can I express a
yes,
concern?
Yes, we don't have much time on this,
okay.
But yes.
I just heard that a lot of rapists are coming from Mexico. Isn't that what Trump said?
Yes.
So how am I not going to get raped if I go out?
It's a real concern. I understand. Because if you look at the statistic, you've got a 98% chance of getting raped. Okay?
That's just math.
Okay, that's my... I'm trying to be PC here.
And I appreciate your concern, but you know, anybody's game in this kind of situation.
Okay.
I'm also worried about you.
Right. Because we know that they are going to try to get me high.
Right.
Because they've got reefer on them.
Because you put it on them.
Exactly.
Okay?
Because we all know that they're dope smoking.
Yes.
They take our jobs, and then eventually they rape our women.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, I saw that movie. Okay. So, what's the smart thing to do here?
Well, I think the smart thing to do is we go out there, all right, and they're going to see you, all right. I'm going to give you something. Okay. And this is something I totally believe in, and I think it's something you believe in too. Okay.
It's a
gun. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, we've done some research, all right? All right, I want you to take this, okay?
All right.
Now. You like that, don't you?
I do.
If you kill them on television...
That's bad optics.
Bad optics.
It doesn't look good to have someone murdered at your rally.
Okay.
I thought I was finishing your thought. That's a new thought for you. You didn't see the optics angle.
No, I didn't see it.
Okay. What were you going to say?
The reason I'm behind this candidate is because I like to kill, you know, for no reason.
We kill for America.
Right. That's what I mean. First, and then we ask questions later. Okay, that's what this country was founded on. I'm just quoting the Constitution.
Okay. Say I'm going to go out there and kill these people.
Yes.
What is the security? No. He gave me this gun. No, it's not my. You asshole! I can't believe this.
I had to. I gotta say, I was very impressed. Because that doesn't seem like a place that you would typically go.
So, obviously, my concerns were incredibly well-founded. So, and oftentimes when I play now, this is what happens in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I think of what I'm going to do, like, you know, just a moment. I think of the thing I'm going to do or say, and then I think, I can't do that. And then I think, okay, now I have to do that. So that happens a lot, and that happened a lot in that scene.
Well, that's
and I
great.
Okay. Like, it all happens very fast, but I'm like, okay, well, now that I can't do it, I have to do it.
But it's interesting because we had this conversation about being offensive, and some
right.
Some people will be listening to this podcast and might think this is offensive.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you?
I might be one of those people.
But as I was watching you do it, it looked like you were a little uncomfortable, but it looked like you were having a blast too.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because I played this way long enough to know that when I think no, I shouldn't do that. Okay, I have to do it. Like I usually know it's gonna. Land.
Right.
Like, oh, I'm onto something because I don't want to do it. That's probably a really good thing to do.
I thought it was really fun. It wasn't what I was expecting.
It was
at all.
Fun. Although, you know, I don't do a lot of like recorded broadcast improv.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I had that split brain moment in my head where I was like, this audience is loving this. Who knows what the other audience at home and in their cars and whatever when they're listening is going to think of. Like, they're not in this room. And improv is so much about what's happening in this room that it's, you know, it's, I don't know if it's going to translate.
I think it's going to translate.
Okay.
Yeah, I really do. And for me, it's like, I've done, you know, I've been doing this podcast over 4 years. I've done so much bad recorded improv that I'm just like, okay. And this was, I thought this was great. And
okay.
I don't usually do, like, I always stay away from political stuff and, you know, so this,
right.
like, totally got me
but
out of
the Trump rally, it's like, you can't avoid that.
Right. But I, when I hear Trump rally, my thing is like, oh, we got to do political. And you threw right into it. And I'm like, you know what? I've got to just go with it.
I
you
thought
know?
You were right into it. So, all right. But I don't think my button landed.
What does that mean?
So, like, my ending. So, I thought, I was trying to do a callback. So, I kept endowing you that you had planted stuff on people.
Okay.
And then I realized once you handed me the gun, I was like, he's planted the gun on me. So now I have to get in trouble with the gun, and it's a setup the whole time.
Okay, I wasn't.
But it didn't land.
Right.
Yeah, it was. I probably should have said something like, the police.
Right. All right, so would you have done anything differently?
I would have landed that button clearer.
Okay.
I would have said, like, he planted, you planted it on me.
Right.
You know, I guess the ending. I mean, besides doing something totally different and not doing that at all. I really liked it.
But don't you think because we played such extremes of characters that it's going to be obvious to people, that was obvious to people in this audience, it's going to be obvious to people that are listening that these people were making fun of or the mentality of what we would think Trump supporters would be?
I hope so. But, you know, it's also like we're two white people, probably of a certain means. There's mostly other white people of a certain means in the room. You know, I don't know. It's like how awesome. I don't know.
Are you self-conscious about this? Are you like, oh, I shouldn't have done this?
No. I'm a little nervous about it. I don't know. It's not clear cut because it's not your. It's hard to be judged on something that's happening in a room when you're not in that room. You know what I mean? Like, because it's so, to me, it's so intuitive. It's like I'm getting a feedback and a feeling from the audience that's telling me this, go in this direction. Mm-hmm. This is working for us here right now.
Well, the audience that listens to this is primarily improvisers.
Yeah, that's true. They'll forgive me, won't they? They're such nice people.
Forgive you for what?
I don't know. Being playing a racist character and a xenophobic character, or like, I don't know. Maybe they're Trump supporters, and maybe they're really, really offended by that.
Are you concerned about offending people in life?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's something that like I'm not a no holds barred comedian. Like, I'm not like, whatever it takes, it'll get the joke. You know, it's like, no, I have boundaries and I have things I believe in, and I don't have everything at my, you know, to use to make comedy because there's things that I don't feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And what's cool now is I feel like there's so many great comedians that are performing in that space, where they're like making it funny to like have those kinds of beliefs and stuff, like, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. they're not exclusive. You can be funny and also like have, you know, certain value. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, it's not just raw comedy, whatever.
So we're going to take some questions and answers from the audience for you.
Good.
All right. And if we want to keep processing this scene, let's go ahead and do that. thanks, Mark, for turning the lights up. We've got questions, so just put your hand. Got one right here.
What aspect of a show would make a show especially memorable for you? What about a show makes it memorable for you?
What part of a show, what aspect of it is going to make it memorable?
Yeah, I like to like ask people, especially in beginning improv, like, how do you know when you're improvising? Because people come there to be in the moment, and like, well, how do you know you're in the moment? So one of the ways that I know I'm really in the moment, and one of the things that's memorable to me, is like when I shock myself, or someone in my team shocks me. Like I like those moments. I'm just like, what is happening? Like, I like those moments. Although I will say, I've done a lot of performing, and I just was at my sister's wedding this Thanksgiving, and I did a toast at this wedding, and this is like going in my top 10 performances, like, of my life, which is totally shocking to me.
What put it up there?
I fucking nailed that. And it's interesting because it's kind of what I thought right away, which is like, it's also about who's in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I said the things that I really wanted to say that came together in the moment in front of the people that I really wanted to hear that message.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you have a great show for not a full, you know, not a great house or whatever, and sometimes vice versa or whatever. So it's nice when it like I had like a get-up show at Out of Bounds a few years ago where it's like, in Scottish Rite Theater, and we nailed it, and it was like, you know what I mean? This was like a great night, where it's like...
So the response...
Great show, great house.
Yeah. Great. Another question? Yes, right here.
What's been your worst moment off stage, or just like, or darkest joke you've actually let fly?
This is related to this off-color that we're talking about. So... I remember it well. We did a format called More or Less, And after every scene, the audience would vote whether they want to see more of that story or less, ending the story and go moving on to another story. So, first scene, I'm playing with Mike D'Alonzo, and he's got this really long beard. Some comically long, like, wrapping around the stage beard. And I'm his wife, and we're shaving it. I don't know. I'm shaving him. Something's happened. I shave his beard. The last line of the scene is, I go, "You're black." Okay. So that's pretty interesting, right? It's like, so, because part of that show, you're going to do a cliffhanger. Like, oh, my God, what? How did she not know? And what does this mean? So the second scene, so then it's like, I'm like, wait. Do you mean our kids, Letitia, and whatever, you know, and like, I'm like using these different like African American touchstones to be like, realize how clueless I am about in my life or whatever. And then like at the end of the scene, I said something like I want a divorce or something like that. And the lights go down and then the audience is like, bless. And so in my mind, it was like, oh, it's going to have this arc where we were like in love, and then we kind of fell out of love, and then it was like, I was going to realize I loved you as you were all along, but like there was no opportunity to do that third scene, and two African-American people in the front row stood up and walked out. Oh. And I felt so shitty. And there was nothing I could do at that moment. I felt like there was nothing I could do at that moment.
You seem like you still feel bad about it.
Oh, yeah. Do you know how many times there's two African-American people at an improv show in Austin? I mean, like... It's a problem. I mean, it's a problem in our community. I think in a lot of improv communities or whatever. So, yeah. And it's also just not, like, how I... Yeah, it was just, you know, it's not... And also not reflective of my personal views, you know? So, yeah, it was suckfest.
Great, another question?
Thanks for asking.
Yes.
So, have you ever thought about trying to move to a bigger market, or have you always been happy with Austin?
I have not really seriously considered moving to a bigger market. Although I do think, like, it would be really fun to be a TV writer, like, being in a room with comedians and, like, writing scripts and telling jokes all day and stuff like that. But I'm kind of like, I've always kind of just gone where I've been called and not so much like, here's where I want to go and I'm going to carve my path, but more kind of like, fine. So if LA was like, can you come write for the Amy Schumer show? I'd be like, yes, I can. But I haven't made any like active plans for that.
Well, you are making a living at improv and teaching
lucky.
And stuff like that. You know, so many people that listen to this podcast hear you and they're like, I you know, because they've been doing shows for free and think improv doesn't pay.
Right.
But what would you tell them?
I mostly do shows for free also. So I don't make much money performing. Although sometimes I do. But I often enjoy that because it's much more fun to perform for free or next to nothing, then, you know, money comes with different strings when you're performing. So I make money teaching, and I have an improv school, and then 50% or actually maybe more now of my company is corporate training. So I think it's my advice would be to sell things to people who have money. And I know that sounds obvious, but I think that lot of times when people have improv theater, they're like trying to sell classes to college students and starving artists, and that's not an easy way to make a living.
Okay, another question. Yeah, back here.
What's it like being married to a muggle?
What's it like to be married to a muggle?
So explain what a muggle is, first of all.
So I'm a wizard. And a muggle is a civilian, a non-wizard. Or actually, it's a non-improviser. This is a Harry Potter term.
Harry Potter, sure.
Hot Harry Potter term, yeah. So I think Asaf means, what's it like to be married to a non-improviser? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's like this in other cities, because you probably travel more than I do, but like there's a lot of improv couples and improv power couples mm-hmm. in town. And I feel like there's sometimes people feel like, how could you marry outside? Again, that line of cult. You know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah. So I think it's great to be married to someone who is a muggle because, number one, I do a lot of improv. I get a lot of improv, so I don't need more of that at home. I also, like, I don't need to do bits at home. You know what I mean? Right. And, like I got all the bits I need. And then... my husband is home right now with our kids while I'm here on stage. So that works out nicely. You know, I think if we both wanted to perform and had to take turns in that way, you know, I think it would be harder, you know, so he can get up in the morning and he can stay home at night and help me do the things I want to do. He's also a professional in the tech industry in Austin, so especially in the days when I was struggling to start a new business, he created a safety net so that I could have those lean years.
Great. Another question? Right here.
Shana, I appreciate that you brought up struggles of being a woman in improv and then later of being a mom and an entrepreneur and a woman. And I wonder, now that you are as successful as you are, is it still a challenge for you? Do you still find that you're confronted with the issues of people maybe looking down on you or not giving you respect or, I don't know, whatever, because you're a woman?
I feel like one of the great things, I mean, I've been doing improv for 20 years, and one of the great things that I feel like has happened in the last 20 years is women's status has really improved in our culture, and improv status has really improved in our culture. And I got older. So just the baby face aspect of that kind of went away. I mean, I'm still like 5 feet tall, so there's something you know there to overcome, but... So in many of those ways, I don't think it's as... And one of the great things is I've been doing improv in Austin for so many years, and I'm kind of one of the founders of the community. So, like, and there's a lot of great women leaders in this community. So it's not... I don't feel like it's like that here, which is awesome. I think that it is still really hard to be a business owner and a mom and a comedian, and balancing those is really... a struggle, because improv shows happen at night, and I'm so tired.
Great, we have one more question, right here.
On the corporate side of things, when you're what's a great corporate success story? I mean, what's the side we don't hear as performers and people taking improv classes on the inside of it?
What is a great corporate success story? That's a good question. I'm trying to think about it as far as like customer client like impact or like successful for me as a. Do you mean like what's really been successful for impactful for a client or
yeah,
what has been
that,
like a
yeah,
win for me?
How do you know when you've really helped a client with something they want to achieve using improv?
Huh, that's a good question. Nice to have data. Thing is that when a client, instead of giving you a one-off engagement, says, we need a tune-up and we need one every quarter or every year because they see the impact and they want you to come back and get, you know, and really deepen the practice. And I have several clients, especially people that do sales, that really want these people to be present and open and in the moment and kind of get like, oh, this is a practice that we need to like, we need a workout. You know what I mean? So that's kind of one of the ways that I know it's been impactful.
Great. There was one more question here.
I was just going to ask, given your success and everything, how, how do you, because you talked about being competitive with other theaters in town, but how do you, as a performer, with all of your experience, keep like that fire burning? How do you challenge yourself?
One, I like to think of myself as an old improv vampire that feeds on the young improvisers that come into my class. So I teach a lot of level one, 101 classes, and seeing, you know, nervous, distant people fall in love with improv and fall in love with each other is just like, you know, it feeds me. And two, a really great, I'm in a group called Girls, Girls, Girls Improvised Musicals. And all women group, sing and dance and wear pink and black. And we have been together for 15 years and we have an annual retreat where we give each other feedback around a fire pit, spirit tribal. And but one of the things they said to me a few years ago and kind of keep saying to me, is they're just like, break the show. You're not responsible here. Mm-hmm. You can just fuck up. And we love it when you do. And that getting that permission from the people I'm playing with, because it's hard when you're a teacher and have taught many of the people that you now play with to not feel still some responsibility for carrying the show or pulling it together or whatever, and just playing with women who are just like, do it, you know, just balls out, just have a blast, get crazy, we got it, you know, is a great, has helped me like kind of open up and grow more, because I do all the homework and I've got all the practice, so I just need to play.
We got to wrap this up. Yeah. We end the podcast the same way.
Oh, yeah.
Asking you one question that you would tell, piece of advice you give to an improviser starting out today.
Oh, right. The piece of advice I would give to an improviser that is starting out today is be fun to work with. You know, be cool, because those people that you're working with now are going to grow and have opportunities. And you want to be the person that they call when they get those opportunities. And that's what's happened for me in Austin. So you want to be the kind of person that's low drama, shows up on time, checks their email, you know, is comes with energy and a good attitude, and has a sense of humor about themselves. So I think it's like a lot about being fun to work with, and the other stuff will fall in line. And you never know who you want a favor from later.
Shannon Merlin, thank you so much.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest from Merlin Works, Shayna Merlin. And I love that lively conversation we had about there are no mistakes in improvisation. And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest from Merlin Works, Shayna Merlin. And I love that conversation we had about her take on mistakes in improvisation. And then we go right into that scene. I'd also like to thank the Institution Theater in Austin, Texas, Tom Booker and Asaf Ronan. I know I got that name right this time, for not only inviting me down to do a couple episodes of Improv Nerd, but also to teach my Artist Low Comedy Workshops. A big thank you to Michael Furstenfeld for recording these episodes, and my producer here in Chicago, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. Without Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, for more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, The Artist Low Comedy here in Chicago, and my improv blog, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, follow us on social media. We've got a Facebook page, so like Improv Nerd. It really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us at improv_nerd on Twitter, and go to our wonderful Improv Nerd podcast, that's YouTube channel. It's Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word, on YouTube. It's little clips. I shouldn't say little. They're clips from our live shows. We are lucky to be part of FeralAudio.com. That's a podcast collective with some of the most unique and innovative and hilarious podcasts out there. People like Chelsea Peretti, Steve Agee, Todd Barry, Dan Harmon, just to name a few. I'd like to thank both our sponsors, the Improvaroo Camping Retreat and the Houston Improv Festival. And of course, I'd like to thank you for listening. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I help people. She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My